Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Season 2 of Path of the Sober Seeker, the space where we explore recovery and personal growth through the lens of Islamic spirituality. My name is James. I'm an American Muslim reaver, a recovering alcoholic and addict, and I'm honored to share this journey with you, and welcome to the show. All right, everyone, I want to thank our guest today. We have Andy H., who I met recently during a trip to New York City. Andy, do you want to go ahead and give our audience just a quick little intro about yourself?
Hey, my name is Andy H., no relation to James H. I almost made you do a spit take there.
Almost.
I've been sober for almost 16 years, coming up on my anniversary. We always like to say the stats. I got sober at 24, turned 40 this year, and getting ready to celebrate 16 years on October 8th. I came to New York City to act, went to multiple acting conservatories, ended up going to film school as well. And, I'm currently in flight school, and just recently got my pilot's license in March and my instrument rating, just last week. And, I'm working on my commercial license and hope to be making films when I'm not flying. So that's my elongated intro. And I also own my own film production company.
Oh, that's amazing. All right. Well, I wanted to ask you, so were you sober when you moved to New York City?
I was definitely not sober.
Right. I was going to say, that's a hard city to stay sober in, man.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do make that move or pull a geographic.
Right.
If they are sober. I mean, it's one of the mega cities, one of the capitals of the world, you know.
Right.
And I moved to the city when I was 18. I came to the city to study acting at a pretty prestigious acting conservatory, but definitely at every opportunity I was looking for booze that I could buy while being underage, and there was a game that I would play with the bodegas across the street from where I live, which is I would show up, you know, on a Friday night. And I would set the six pack or the, you know, 24 case on, you know, in front of this guy who's behind like the bulletproof glass. And then he would be like, here you go. And I like start to pay for it. And he's like, well, where's your ID? And I'm like, oh, damn. It's like across the street in my apartment building. I can go get it. And I would leave this pause and kind of like, you could see the ellipse.
Right.
I would like look at him and I'd be like, but I'm going to go to a different bodega and they're going to sell it to me. And he's like, okay, just this time. And yes. So I would do that every Friday. And then there was I lived on the Upper West Side when I first moved to the city. And there was this grocery store called Pioneer, which is still open. And they never carded me. So once I realized that they never carded me, I started just going buying groceries, but mainly alcohol.
Right.
I would get, you know, I started to realize there was a problem when I would buy like they used to have a keg can for Foster's beer. And it was, I mean, no offense to people who really enjoy Foster's. I think it's like piss water. and I no offense, Australian. I love Australian people, and I work with a lot of Australians in the film world. But Foster's, I don't think represents them very well. And I got this keg can, which was like basically like a liter of beer. And I bought it and I brought it home, and it was still warm from the store from being on the shelf. It like wasn't in.
Oh no!
It wasn't in the refrigeration, and I had this cup, which was like a huge fucking plastic cup, and I used to call it the King's cup because it was like fucking massive. And apologies, I'll try not to cuss so much. And I was drinking this warm piss beer, And I realized I didn't have any plans for the day. And I was just going to stay in my room and drink. And that was kind of like,
Right.
oh man, like, this
Is
is
that like
not normal.
was that like your moment of clarity when you're like, maybe I'm drinking a little alcoholically?
No, I was just like, I don't know, is this just what like adults do? Like they just like
Right.
they drink by themselves and like they don't meet up with friends and things like that. And
Oh man. That's wow. I met you at the mustard seed just last week, and one of the I don't know if you were at that meeting, but someone said something very profound that the opposite of addiction is connection. And that's one of those things in like active addiction, like so much we fall into this sense of just like isolation. You know, and what a weird experience to be in, especially someplace like New York City, which is like, you know, millions of people stacked on top of each other. And it's just there's all these potential connections everywhere. And there you are sitting in your apartment by yourself, you know, chugging warm beer. It's
It's exactly.
it's one of
It
those things. It's pretty.
I love that phrase that you said, and I totally agree. There was a moment where I told myself that there was a bear trap under my bed. And if I didn't leave my room and go out and audition or look for a new, cater waiter job or whatever, then I realized I would stay in my bed all morning and I would just get it stuck in my thoughts. And even in early sobriety, they said like, practice the four M's, which is meetings, movies, meditation, and masturbation.
Wow.
I would get stuck in the other three and not get out and get to a meeting and like, take my medicine,
So wild to me. Like we have that's the thing with like because I got sober in Ohio and we have such a different approach because our four we have the four absolutes, which is honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. And there you are in New York doing the four M's, which is it's awesome. But you know, obviously it worked for you if you did it. So what was your early sobriety like? Because it is, you know, New York, there's a lot of you could find pretty much anything there. So that level of temptation is there. Was there like any crossover with you know, I know that acting takes a certain, you know, actually a high degree of personal discipline, especially. How has and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how that discipline has maybe you know, either transferred or strengthened your spiritual discipline working a program.
I think accountability is like a big part of that discipline, going to multiple conservatories, I was given the tools. The tools were laid at my feet, much like, the spiritual, work and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The tools were laid at my feet when I was working what was laid out to me by a sponsor in the big book, you very, very simply, there is a recipe to good acting as well as there is a recipe to bad sobriety, right? Or good sobriety. And for me, I could relate, that discipline that, you're asking me about as well as early sobriety. Early sobriety was really challenging for me when it came to act like, or before I was sober because of I had to be accountable to time that I was wasting. You kill a lot of time when you are drunk and when you're looking for drugs and alcohol, you're killing all
Right.
that time. And meanwhile, every time you get fucked up, you're like, okay, I feel better. That spiritual sickness, the hole is filled momentarily. But then you're like, oh fuck, I should be out there auditioning. I missed my shot,
Right.
And it's like, but then once that time is available to you, because you're no longer getting fucked up, I was much more accountable, and I would show up to auditions, but I had to face the fear.
Right.
Courage isn't the absence of fear, but rather showing up
Right.
regardless of that fear. There was moments where I went into auditions and I had just read a book called The War of Art, and it talked about how Henry Fonda. He w every day he threw up before he went on stage on for Broadway, and it wasn't because of being drunk. It was nerves, right?
Right.
They say for actors, before you get on stage or on set, your heart rate will jump to the heart rate of a pilot, a naval pilot, before he gets catapulted off of the carrier.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's in relation to how big the spectacle you're doing. Like if it's a Steven Spielberg movie, you're gonna get that feeling. If it's
Right.
your community theater for the first time, maybe you'll get it the first time, maybe not so much. But
what is it like if you have like, I mean, if you, I feel like with film, you get a little bit of a safety net because you have like retakes. But if you're doing public speaking, like a lot of our listeners are, you know, members of AA, obviously, and they lead meetings, and we get some meetings with hundreds and hundreds of people, and it's nerve wracking because a lot of people, it's just an average drunk. They don't necessarily have a background in public speaking. Is it you actually have it? You have a lot more like trepidation and stress going into a film situation versus like a stage situation where you don't get a retake.
They're both. They have their own quirks. You know, the good thing about live theater is you're getting live feedback from the audience. You're like, oh, they're with me or they're not with me. They're laughing at the jokes or they're not laughing at the jokes.
Right, right.
We're running long or we're like, oh, wow. Like it's like snap, crackle, pop. Everything's happening. Where
like firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, firing
like,
all
cylinders. Right, right,
yeah,
right,
you're
right.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, fuck, they're feeling it. Maybe we'll get a standing ovation or maybe we'll shit the bed in the middle, you know, like.
This is great.
But film world, I mean, the preparation still needs to be done, you know, just like I'll relate it back to the steps. Like step one is step one for a reason, right? It's the foundation for everything. The foundation for acting is know your lines. You know, they said for a lot of famous directors like Stanley Kubrick, who like famously would do like 100 takes with like Shelley Duvall before like The Shining, in moments of The Shining, and it like broke her. And he's like, you know, also it's the stress of being with a director. You want to hit the mark, but at the same time, it's like, well, do you know your lines? You know, and then back to sobriety, it's like, okay, do you want to stay sober today? Do you accept that you have a problem? And that you're willing to acknowledge, you know, and have that surrender. And now we have a basis of doing something. If you know your lines, then now you can make choices. Now you can be in the moment. But that's the step one of
acting.
That's
true. Well, a big part of it is like you have to go. I mean, because there's a lot of people who are still in active addiction at step one. There's actually a bar near where I live in Ohio, where they will give you a free drink. If you go in and put an AA chip on the bar, they'll give you a free drink. And there's a lot of people in there that just don't care. Like they laugh about it, and it's like they joke around about being a high functioning alcoholic while they're drinking away. And it's and I know that because I was one of those people for a long time before I got sober again. And it's you know, so for me, I didn't really start you know, because the steps, it's a the point of the steps isn't to get sober. The point of the steps is to have that spiritual awakening, and sobriety is the price of admission. You know, we get sober first, but step one's the only one that mentions alcohol. So when you step, you know, step two, coming to believe in that power greater than yourself, it's turning everything over to, you know, the will of Allah or God or whatever the power, you know, higher power of your understanding is. It's where it really starts to, you know, the rubber hits the road. So I wanted to ask you, how did your, you know, because obviously working the steps, everyone's view of spirituality and their relationship with their higher power grows and evolves. How has that gone with you, you know, as far as, you know, weaving acting into that with your spiritual practice?
So I would say it's definitely grown both, you know, if I was talking to my sponsee, I would say everything grows in relation to your spiritual life, you know, when the spiritual bank account is full. Your actual bank account gets full. Oh, is it odd or is it God? You know,
right.
Like,
yeah, if your
spirit is full, your art is probably going to be better. And I will say this: just before I got sober, so I'll put this in there. You know, I met a woman. I chased a woman into the rooms who had been sober for almost 10 years, and I met her on a dating site. And she was like, hey, we're just going to get tea. And I was like, okay, I like tea. You know, like for me, I thought we were talking like code, you know, for like having sex or whatever.
Right.
And then eventually, yeah, we did just get tea. We actually talked, had really great conversations. And then I found out about what her spiritual practice was. And I got really interested. But like, I came into the rooms already practicing meditation. And the day that I really focused, I really knew that I wanted to stop. I was on the way to a 10-day meditation retreat, and I threw the joint that I was smoking out of the window on the way to this 10-day meditation retreat. And then after the moment it went out the window, I was like, fuck.
Right.
I was like, why did I do that? You know? And I feel like, to wrap it up is for this particular question, it's just your spirit is, you know, that it's all off that soul sickness that you're talking about. And I agree, you know, we're here for the spiritual experience, and we get, you know, for me, it's not just like one God in particular. It's a universal outlet that has many names. And for me, I get to enjoy all of those names because of this program. You know,
right.
I grew up as a Christian, but, you know, I get to do a lunch line mentality, get to take a little bit of every religion that I like. And
right.
I get to, you know, I get to practice and see the many faces of God. But the one face for me is love. That is
absolutely
it.
Right. Well, that's another positive aspect of living in New York City, because you have a literal melting pot of pretty much every culture on the planet. I mean, you can have a synagogue literally a block away from a masjid, but there could be a Hindu temple like another block away from that. There's just so many different spiritual traditions all in the same place. So I did notice quite a bit of spiritual diversity at the different meetings and whatnot I went to, which is freaking awesome. You know, and you're absolutely right. I did want to touch on something you said about how when your heart is full, your art is full, which is, you know, I think that's such a beautiful thing, because there's so much of... you know, so many things in our culture, especially apply to like thought and thinking, and things like creativity that comes from the heart. But the heart is being taken out of a lot of things. Take like education, for example. Art classes are being cut, even forms of like masculine creativity, like shop classes, you know, building, things like that are being cut in favor of state mandating testing, which all applies to the head. And none of that sings to, no one looks at a spreadsheet and it fills their heart with joy versus, you know, looking like, yeah, you know, looking at
except
like,
the accountant.
Right, the accountant, right? But no one's going to look at math and be like, oh, this is freaking, you know, fills my heart with joy. And no one's going to be moved to, you know, move as opposed to listening to like a beautiful piece of music or looking at a beautiful piece of art that is going to call to their heart. You know, so that's a really interesting point, because like when your heart is full and you're doing the will of your higher power, and it is always, you know, and you're right, it always comes down to taking the most loving choice in anything. My mom was my mom passed away in 2011. She was sober for 17 years when she passed, and she was she would always tell me, James, you need to always choose the most loving option. Whenever you're faced with a dilemma, always choose love. And that's a really beautiful thing when you brought that up about that's how your higher power speaks with you.
I also would just throw in there like there's a couple things that, you know, I like the Odin, the old Viking and Norse traditions, and they talk about truth being, you know, the Mjolnir, and truth is so important in the steps, you know, truth with yourself, actually seeing what is actually, you know, you brought it back to the meeting the other day of acceptance, you know, truth could also, you know, if it's untampered, it can be very cutting. And it needs to be a loving truth. Well, you know, it has needs to have compassion in there.
Well, honesty without compassion is brutality. So you have to do that. But then again, you can't be too, especially because we're recovering addicts, you know, and an addict is nothing more than an experienced escape artist. So sometimes sometimes like if it's a sponsee or someone who's being like particularly stubborn or trying to work angles or do different things, you have to kind of cross that threshold into tough love. You know, where you do add a little, maybe a little bit more honesty and a little bit less compassion, which is, you know, I kind of needed that. It's, you know, at various times where I need to be, you know, you need to realize like, hey, play the tape through. If you continue on this path, it's not going to end well for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about that, the vigorous program, of, you know, vigorous self-honesty. And it even says that in our daily readings, the people who fail are people who cannot or will not. You know, and can't pray or constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And that's the thing, is if we're, we're used to BSing the world around us, but when we get to the point where we're BSing ourselves, especially to, justify our addiction. And that's one thing we talk about in our meetings. We call that mental masturbation. You know, that level of like, you know, that level of like self-justification, because we can talk ourselves in and out of anything. And how many drunks have had to explain? You're like, oh, well, it seemed like a good thing to do at the time, Your Honor, you know, because it's so it just seems like, because we do have that twisted thinking, but it's all up there in our head. And I just wanted to bring that back to your point about having our heart full. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we could do something where our head is trying to get us in trouble. Our heart is going to remain in alignment with our higher power and is going to keep mm-hmm. us out of that, you know, keep us on that straight path.
Well, the next right action, you know, that we come back to, it has to have that element of compassion and God's will or your higher power's will is usually not, sometimes it's gray, sometimes it's black and white. But it has an element of positivity
right.
almost always, you know,
right.
like God's will is not always like, you know, go get vengeance, kill that person.
Yeah, not yes. Every now and then I try to avoid the gray areas, because especially when I was in active addiction, I was very guilty of doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. You know, I heard a comedian talk about one time that an addict is someone who will steal your car and then help you look for it. because it's like, no, think about it. Because it's like, I think of times where I was trying to work angles or being, you know, acting very manipulative and things, doing the right thing, you know, on the surface, but I was still had my own agenda.
Yeah.
And that's one thing with especially getting into later sobriety, like I really start to look at my motives with things.
Your intentions. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that's the thing in Islam, like Allah judges us on our intentions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very important that I make sure that my heart is in the right place, because it is really, really easy to do the right thing for the wrong reasons. At the same time, we could use that justification to do the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard a lot of, and a lot of people will get into that, you know, morality versus legality debate. Like, if your family's starving, is it appropriate to steal a loaf of bread to feed your family? Mm-hmm. You're stealing, yet at the same time, you're feeding your family. And it, but it's, I feel like when it comes to things like morality, you could split hairs all day.
Mm.
You know, the thing is it has to call, you know, if you're doing the right action from your heart mm-hmm. and your intention is correct, then you're correct.
Yeah. I like to bring it back to, you know, in sobriety, if your spiritual armor is on, if you've gone to a meeting, if you're talking to your sponsees, your sponsor, you're checking in with your war council of other alcoholics.
War council.
And
I love that. Yeah.
I mean, my sponsee calls it his team. You know, and
right.
then your intent is right. You can truly go anywhere in the world.
Right.
You know, you can walk. You could, like, I used to be a bartender in sobriety, you know, working as a cater waiter in between auditions. And I was thankful that, you know, my higher power had relieved the, you know, my craving for my alcoholism.
Right.
You know, and it was about, It was about you know, being of service to other people. And so my intent was right. And I usually would start my day and end it with a meeting. So that always helped too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. I heard that. That's another thing I heard at the Mustard Seed, with taking the meeting the day with the meeting instead of, you know, bringing your meeting to the day instead of the day to the meeting. Which is really, you know, it's good. I was actually at my, I was at a meeting this morning. I do a 7 a.m. one here in the Cleveland area. It's every day we do the daily reflections. And it was good to do that. I was looking at the clock at 7:30, though. I'm like, yeah, those Mustard Seed guys are getting started right about now, man. Like, do it. It's, you know, it's funny. One of my, I was talking with my sponsor about this, that the longest record that anyone has ever stayed sober is 24 hours. And the Big Book, it talks about that, you know, the only thing we're guaranteed is that, you know, the daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that's part of that, you know, the prayer, the meditation, going to meetings. In meetings, that's such an important aspect of recovery, because that's the action. You know, you actually have to get up and go somewhere to go to a meeting. And I guess in the tech age, you could do, you know, go to a Zoom call meeting or something. But at the same time, it requires a degree of action on your part. Prayer, it's action to a lesser degree. Meditation is pretty much just sitting there. It's pretty passive. But doing the action of actually getting up out of your comfort zone, like you mentioned, being in your apartment, you know, isolating, drinking by yourself, getting out and going somewhere, mm-hmm. It's a major action. And that's how you get stuff, you know, get stuff moving.
Yeah, the prison can be in your mind.
Right.
But it could also be your physical apartment or house that you feel safe in. You know, I've had moments where Yeah, that bear trap technique that I talk about. I also use it for sober activities. Like, I'm going to do 5 minutes of meditation, but then I get stuck in that meditation because I enjoy the benefits and that prayer. And so, next thing you know, that 15 minutes becomes 20, that 20 becomes 30, that 30 becomes an hour, you know? Yeah, the discipline, it bears fruit. This meditation teacher I listened to, he's like, if you want bitter fruit, you plant negative ideas. If you want positive things in your life, you plant positive things.
Who's the teacher?
His name is Goenga, and it's Vipassana, and so it's
Okay.
non it's not
Okay.
associated with any religion, and
Okay.
I'll, yeah.
All right, I'm going to ask you for the spelling of that later. I will put it in the show notes so anyone out there who wants to, pursue this, we'll have it in the show notes for the episode. That's absolutely fantastic. So what I wanted to ask you about is the so like with your when you were setting up your personal spiritual framework, okay, how did that differ to where you are now in later sobriety versus where you were in early sobriety?
So, in early sobriety, it was about taking my medicine and starting out the day early on. I would bookend my days with meetings.
Right.
I would go to a meeting before I worked my restaurant job. And then after the restaurant job, I would go to another meeting and I would be exhausted afterwards. Sometimes I would work, when you're 20 or something, you think that you have unlimited energy. So I would work like three jobs because I didn't have a girlfriend. I lived in a shit apartment. And so I'd be like, oh, I'll do construction in the morning. I'll do a restaurant in the during the day, and then I'll go to another restaurant job. And then, in between,
Right.
I would. Sobriety was my primary purpose. And so that's how it was in the beginning. And I really set the foundation, right? Talking about the recipe. The recipe is going to meetings, working the big book with a sponsor. And then once you make it through the steps to, help others, extend the
Right.
hand of AA and prayer and meditation to continue
Awesome
that
work.
growth. And so like for me, like what I'm doing today, man, my day is full. So I have
Right.
to make time for the meetings. And so in the morning, I'll usually like I'll meditate and I will think I'll still try and plan out those meetings. Whether if it's like a Zoom meeting, I've kind of been cheating. I've been doing Zoom meetings. I drive 100 miles a day to flight school right now. And so I'll put a Zoom meeting on. And
Right.
most of the time they won't call me and I'll be in the car and I'll just be focusing on driving, but I'll get to hear a good qualification. And here's a hack that some people don't really do as much. But so there's these tapes called the Joe and Charlie tapes. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Right. Oh, of course.
Yeah, and so I downloaded them to iTunes in early sobriety. And I would put my music on shuffle, and next thing you know, I would be jamming out to a tune, and then the next one would be Joe or Charlie coming. All right, everyone settle down. Step four. And I'm like,
Yes.
okay, all right, I'm gonna get a meeting. I didn't plan it. And I'm on the subway, or I'm riding my bike. And that was a
Right.
great hack because it kept me like dialed in. And they're talking the language of the heart. I'd be on a plane trip. And all of a sudden I'd be like, all right, this is my meeting for right now,
Right.
and so I check in with my sponsee every day. We do a little voice note to each other that we send via on Apple phones. It's just like a quick little soundbite back
Right.
and forth. And then I talk to my sponsor probably like once or twice a month, and I run into him at meetings. So I try and stay locked in, but meditation is really how I kind of carry myself between the meetings, and I pray continuously
Right.
all
Yes,
the time,
I same thing.
especially in flight school.
Oh, right.
I like this little hack. The other hack is like you pretend that you're tying your shoe and then you go down to one knee and then you like futz with your, tying your shoelace, but really say that prayer. And for me, the seven step prayer, I love it because every time I put it on, I get a visceral feeling like I'm putting on, like, I don't know if you played football or anything, or like I played rugby and football and all these contact sports because I was trying to you know, prove something when I was a young man. But like when I put, right. when I say the seven step prayer or even the third step, I feel like I'm putting on my pads and I'm like, all right, let's go do a good deed today. You know, like let's not be an angel in the meeting and then a devil in the streets.
Right. That's common, man. But that's, you mentioned that earlier as far as like putting on your armor of God. So it's like that metaphorical spiritual armor. Let me ask you about meditation real quick, because you've mentioned that several times. Being in an environment like New York City, obviously there's a lot of moving parts all the time. So when you, it sounds like you have to take that conscious, make a conscious effort to be able to unplug from all of that and plug into that sense of serenity.
Yeah. When we were talking about this podcast, you had said, made an analogy that has kind of worked on me. The city is a storm, you know, right. And I would call it a vortex. You know, it's a spiritual vortex where
it's
like
a nexus point, man.
It's a nexus point. You have to right. ride above the storm. You know, right. when they do imagery of the hurricanes, they can't fly directly through the hurricanes. You got to be like 40,000 feet, you know, up
to get there. To the calm and the sun and the eye, man. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if we're locked in, then you don't feel the undertow of the city. You could be anywhere right. in the world. You could be in Dayton, Ohio. You know, right. you could be in LA. You could be in Japan, and you get to float from that 30,000 foot view and kind of look down and be like, I get to do this today. I get to do
Beautiful.
That today. You know, this is a gift of sobriety. What it, and then look for opportunities to help other people, like, you know, that lady crossing the street or whatever. I like holding doors for people and never telling about it, you know, because
right.
like that is like, okay, I put one little dollar in my spiritual bucket, you know? But to you said, I don't know if that answered your question there. I kind of rambled on.
No, it's okay. No, it's awesome, actually. And there are so many opportunities for, you know, to do things like that, especially in the city. So many good deeds that need to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, in the city, I actually said this to you. New Yorkers love to, they love to give directions. Despite what, you know, the 80s and 90s movies will have you believe, where like you go up to someone, they're like, screw you, why are you talking to me, you know, give me money. It's like in New York, really, if they see someone who's a brand new tourist and you're like, hey, I'm sorry, I'm lost, they're like, oh yeah, sure thing, you need to go down the queue.
So when I was in the city last week, I had so many people were, New York City obviously has a reputation of people being rude, people being mean, saying all these things. And it was the exact opposite of what I experienced. I met some of the coolest freaking people. And it's like you could tell if someone's like either high or, you know, they're messing around and whatnot. And I was kind of was able to know who to avoid eye contact with and who I mm-hmm. could, you know, engage with freely. But for the most part, people were real, real cool, helping me out with the subway, directions, pretty much anything. And I met some very, very friendly people, which is, again, was the exact opposite of the reputation that New York City has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, New York will surprise you multiple different ways. I was raised in North Carolina and born in Germany. The thing about New York is there are characters, just like all the other mega cities of the world. There are characters all over the place. With New York, I mean, you get surprised. There's a lot of really nice people and people who are willing to just help. Like, I mean, I've fallen on my bike, you know, and then people have come over and it's a community. Just think of it this way. Like, if you lived in an off, like my dad's from a small town in Ohio, maybe you've heard of it, called Ada, Ohio. And I'm from a small town called Apex, North Carolina. And my mom's from a small town called Stevensville, Montana, where everyone knows your name type right. of cheers action. Where, like, of course they're going to help you because you know exactly where they live and everyone's talking gossip. But in New York, all those towns are just squished together. It's like 20 towns on top of each
other. Right, like the different neighborhoods.
Yeah, and different neighborhoods. And so, like, you can't remember all the faces, but there is a kind of sentiment of, like, well, yeah, I'm going to help you if you're in need. I mean, we're human, you know?
Right.
But as alcoholics, I want to get mine, you know? It's a rat race, you know? I feel like if you're nameless and faceless in a car, yeah, you're going to see the New York mentality you think you got on those 80s and 90s movies.
Right.
You know, but when you're face to face, as long as you're not pushing your way through Times Square, most people are pretty cool.
It was, yeah, I could see it. It's I did love the sense of like anonymity, though. It's like the thing with, because those things in the small towns, it's a double-edged sword. Like, yeah, everyone knows your name, but also everyone's up in your business.
100%.
You know, everyone's up in your business. And I've never, I think one of the things I love about New York is it's that sense of like, no one cares. You know, there's a, the word for it is Sonder, where everyone, like literally everyone you know is living a life that is just as, they have just as detailed and as intense of an inner world as you do.
Everyone's a main character,
right?
No,
yeah,
one's
everyone's
an NPC.
Right, exactly. And I see that a lot in New York, because it's like a lot of people walking around, they all have their headphones in, they're all listening to their own music, their own whatever they're listening to, they're in their own space. You know, I've seen it in the everyone on the subway with a 1,000-yard stare, you know, just looking off into, you know, and it's like, okay, this is like really, it really was a sense of anonymity, which I find interesting, because if you tie it back to the you know, with Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about anonymity as a spiritual foundation of all of the traditions. So there is that sense of, you know, spirituality and getting lost in a crowd, which was beautiful. It was almost freeing. You know, it was very, very, very beautiful. It was a very beautiful feeling to be able to see that.
Yeah, I mean, to have back to acting, you had to get trained to live as you would privately in a public space. Right. And in New York, I think that's hilarious about the 1,000-yard stare. I mean, you have to have a sense of protection to be able to go into yourself that deep, you know, because if you when you hear about other communities like Eastern culture with the Chinese and especially Japanese or Korean, they have literal social masks. Like,
right.
There's what you have with your family, with your lover, with the public, and then like with your business. And each one of those are layered in a certain way. In New York, we just probably have three, you know, like, you know, but there's, but yeah, anonymity, like, think about this, like, in those mega cities, like New York, and when there were the groups that were getting together. The Oxford groups that were practicing radical Christian beliefs, which really they all, you know, they all extrapolate and are aligned with other spiritual values of all the other faiths, you know. But like when they started doing AA meetings, it would be like they would have a little latch and they would look, they would see if they noticed the person or if they knew who that was. And if they didn't know who it was, they wouldn't unlock the door. They wouldn't let you into the AA room. It would be like the speakeasy.
Yeah, I was gonna say the speakeasy.
Yeah,
man.
they would take that same mentality of like the secrecy of drinking into AA. Now look at today, where all these, you know, for better or worse, people who aren't practicing the tradition of anonymity and TV and film and everything, and when there's really famous people that, you know, live their lives as a sober and sometimes non-sober individual,
right?
Public, you know. But it does give it makes it more sexy sometimes when you hear someone like Brad Pitt being like, you know, openly sober for
right.
however long he's been sober.
Well, I mean, statistically, people are drinking a lot less, but other substances are always, you know, always being used. And we call it, you know, anything that takes you out of yourself or mood. I try to shy away from the mood and mind altering substance explanation, because half the people, at least I know in our Meyer, they smoke with cigarettes, and it's like you take away your cigarettes for half a day. just half a day and tell me that's not going to affect your mood. Tell me that nicotine's not
or,
a mood alter.
Or this coffee that you right. and I are enjoying right now.
Right. I can't. Dude, I will freely admit that I am addicted to caffeine. I just, it's just, is what it is. It's Astaghfir Allah, Allah, forgive me, but it is what it is, man. I'm very, I'm, you know, I need my caffeine. Morning, yeah. noon, and night, man. It's
straight to the veins.
It's wild. All right. Well, I want to kind of change gears here a little bit. If you want to, you know, we have a lot of listeners that are, you know, people with early sobriety, late sobriety, however you want to look at it. I feel like with your program, you have a lot of experience staying sober in a chaotic environment, obviously in New York City. Do you have any, you know, wisdom you could share with anyone or advice for anyone who might be maybe not necessarily like the city environment, but dealing with those chaotic moments and how to maintain serenity?
So I would relate it to someone who has she's broken her own anonymity, but she wrote this this book and she talked about, you know, creating a bullet point of people who give you energy, you know, do like we talked about your inner circle. I call it my war council.
Right.
And I start with those three people that like they know every intimate detail about me and they're going to be honest about what God's will actually probably is when I want to skew it my own way. They're going to be rigorously honest and they're going to be like, Andy, do you really think you're higher power wants you to quit your job and move to fucking wherever. And
say
so,
group consciousness. I mean,
that group exactly.
That's and how you.
It's really helpful because they help you see your blind spot,
right?
We all have those blind spots. So I think that really helps minimize the chaos. Having a really strong tribe that you create for yourself in New York, we definitely have to do that. And it could be anywhere. Like say you have a military background. And you have to trust your squad before you can trust your unit, before you can trust, you know, the brigade, you know, you know, and because the problems extrapolate. Other than that, like I would say, like, you know, to minimize chaos, you got to get real simple, you know, bring it back to your budget. You know, like if you are living outside your means, you got to go back to what do I really need? You know, we need meetings. We need to talk to other alcoholics. We need to pay the bills. So maybe you should show up on time for work. And then maybe you should eat a good meal so that you feel well. I love, there's this one girl that says like, treat yourself like a race car, like a Ferrari. Give yourself really good high octane foods and get 8 hours of sleep. And then each day, like you said, it's only a 24-hour reprieve. So if you start real small, you could build a lot. You know, I also love the mentality of like get 1% better every day. And I would say that in the chaos, you're more likely to get depressed when you're not moving forward, you know.
Right.
And if you don't feel like you're improving yourself or helping other people, that's when I get depressed. That's when I get in my head and I have to get into action. So and then, yeah. There's this amazing prayer I want to give a shout out to. It's called the Desiderata Prayer. And it's a poem by Max Ehrman. And they read it in the AA meetings in Holland, especially Amsterdam. And that is kind of like, instead of reading the promises, they'll read this Desiderata Prayer. And one of the phrases in it is stay away from I naturally stay away from vexatious people. And I would also include, you know, places where it's going to it's I don't think it's Max Ehrman. And I think that's another book. I'll send it to you. And yeah, I think staying away from vexatious people who are energy vampires from you and people who and you know it's your life, you know, like create a list of 10 things that give you love and joy and then try and do those 10 things as soon as possible every
that's
day.
Amazing. That's absolutely beautiful. Yeah, I that's a lot to take in, you know. It's really easy to you know, it is, you know, we talk about, you know, basic things, especially in early sobriety, you know, sober people, sober places, sober things. And I guess that insinuates, you know, you're doing your 90 meetings in 90 days. You're around people who have that strong relationship with their higher power working a healthy program. But there still has to be a degree of discernment because there are, you know, there are negative people in the rooms. You know, there are people who are those negative vampires who, you know, the energy vampires will try to suck you into their, you know, to their nonsense, you know, and it's, and sometimes we get sucked into our own nonsense. Like we could be our own energy vampire. I struggle with that sometimes. Like I love a, you know, like any good drunk, I love a good pity party. You know, I do. I do, man. I love it. If we allow, and it can be a luxury. You know, I allow myself like that luxury of self-pity, and it is, you know, it's very, very dangerous. It's a very slippery slope.
Pour me a drink.
Pour me a drink, right.
Yeah. It's, I just want to throw in there, so I'm going to read this phrase from the actual poem. It says, go placidly among amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quietly and clearly and listen to others. And even to the dull and ignorant, they too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexatious to the spirit. And I'll just, and there's a lot more, but like, wow, so much in those nuggets, right?
Right.
And that is kind of New York, right? If there's a guy who's peeing in the corner on the subway, there are some people who are sicker than others. Maybe you should go to a different car in the subway. And
right.
In your life, if you see someone, I saw someone swerving on the road on the highway the other day, and it was Labor Day weekend. And I decided I was going to get out of his way, and I was going to, you know, I was going to pray for that individual.
Right, pray for them.
Yeah.
It's there's a lot of good reminders. Like I was walking around the city last week, and there's so many, a lot of people passed out drunk sleeping on sidewalks. And that to me is a reminder. I'm like, you know, that, you know, there, but for the grace of God go I. Mm-hmm. And it's a good reminder because I am, you know, like most of us, I am literally one drink away from that. You know, it might not happen overnight, but, you know, this is a progressive disease. And it is, you know, I've been homeless in the past. And it is, you know, it's entirely possible that's still waiting for me. It's still waiting for all of us. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
that car swerving on the highway, that's your one drink away from that.
Yeah, it's all a yet. And I'll say this, there's a buddy of mine who he is not a member of this group. And I firmly believe that we all need to diagnose our own selves to your own self, you know, have that surrender, that acceptance. But he was living, he did three tours in Afghanistan and he came back and he was doing the cocaine and Taco Bell diet for multiple months. And he spent all of his hazard pay going to strip clubs, Taco Bell, and living homeless, you know? And like, wow, like, you know, that's all a yet, you know?
Right.
Who knows if you're going to cash out your 401k and then just try and kill yourself with a bottle. You don't know.
It's waiting for all of us, you know? And the only thing, again, we have that daily reprieve. And the way we avoid that is that maintenance of that spiritual condition, you know, the prayer, mm-hmm. meditation, staying that conscious contact, you know, that we're always trying to, that we're always trying to strive for. All right, Mr. Andy, listen, we're coming to just about the end of our time for the podcast today. One of the things I do, we do here on Path of the Sober Seekers, I always ask for a book recommendation from from the guests. So do you have anything you've been reading lately? Maybe anything that's been, you know, inspiring you, anything you want to share?
Yeah, I'm going to say that this particular gentleman, he planted the seed when I was not ready to get sober. And his name is Dr. Wayne Dyer. He's no longer with us. And he has a book called The Power of Intention. And it's not related to any religion. Really, it's about just kind of, you know, seeking your own true purpose. But he talks about, you know, the power of meditation, about how we can always connect to God, to higher power at any moment. And he also talks about, you know, like some, we talked about the power of intention, you know, we're all walking liabilities, but if you're spiritually fit and your intentions are in good alignment, you can go anywhere. But also with the power of intention, you can create and you could do things that you never dreamed were possible. I would say that everyone, including myself, even with my 16 years of sobriety, my idea of what I need and what my goals are in life are nothing in comparison to what your higher power and your his goals are for you, or its goals are for you.
Right.
And I would say, you know, a thimbleful of willingness gets a lot. And I would say that this book really set, and I read it in college, and I listened to the audiobook and as well. And man, he was a very compassionate man, but he gave me, you know, this little jewel to start to seize some of my dreams, first as an actor, and then eventually as a camera guy and owning my own production company, and now as a licensed pilot and being in flight school.
Mashallah. Awesome. That's absolutely amazing. All right, Andy, it's been an absolute honor and pleasure to have you on today. Thank you so much. To all of our listeners, anyone out there, if you're struggling, please, please, please pick up the phone before you pick up the bottle. You know, make a good decision, call, talk to someone before you pick up. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Path of the Sober Seeker. And inshallah, we'll be back next week with another guest. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful day.